Hello, Dr. Chidi. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. We're really happy and excited to have you on board, and thank you for doing this. As we want to introduce you with a little bio that says that you were born in Nigeria and you grew up in NYC. Is that correct?
That's correct, in the Bronx.
Okay, would you like to tell us more about that? What was
Yeah,
the
for sure. So I grew up. Well, I was born in Nigeria in the eastern part of the country. Both my parents are Igbo. I'm Igbo as well. And we actually immigrated to New York City and specifically to the Bronx when I was 2 years old. And then the rest of my siblings were born here in America. And so I really grew up in a bicultural household. I was going to school in America. I was living in America. But within our household, my parents did, I think, the best job that they can do instilling a lot of Nigerian values and Igbo values in our household. We also ate Nigerian food, watched Nigerian movies, but at the same time, we're assimilating to what it meant to live in America in a new country with all the opportunities that the country was affording my family and myself.
Right, absolutely. That sounds wonderful. There's a little bit more about Nigerian food.
Yeah, so Nigerian food,
Do you
if you talk
still
to
cook?
any.
I'm sorry, I'm interrupting. Do you still
No,
cook?
it's okay. So I can cook. Now, whether or not I want to cook for other people is a different story. I don't think my cooking is one that I will, compete with other like more
Okay.
established chefs,
Well,
including myself.
we need some more recipes. We need to
Yeah.
share that.
But I do
We're gonna
appreciate
bug you on that later.
it.
But at the moment, you're doing your PhD and an MD program at Harvard Medical School, right?
Yeah, right.
So how did you think about pursuing this career? What motivated you, and how did you go into this field?
Yeah, so both my parents actually came to the United States and studied to become nurses. And so I grew up in a household that was surrounded by medicine. And for my parents, nursing was their way to access the American dream. And so they were studying to become nurses while I was going to elementary school and also high school. And I think that initially piqued my interest in medicine. Not only that, I always loved science growing up as a child. That was my favorite subject. And to me, medicine was a way to apply science to actually improve people's lives. And so medicine came early to me as a passion at a young age, as did science. And the summer after high school, I participated in my first research experience where I did infectious disease research at the Weill Cornell Medical School here in New York City. And that ever since that experience, I have continued doing research all the way up to doing a master's at the University of Cambridge, and then a PhD at Harvard. And that's because the MD was my way of using science to give back to people, but also the PhD was my way of actually doing science, conducting research, asking questions, pushing the boundary of knowledge forward to ultimately impact medicine and improve the human condition. So that's why, in short, the MD PhD was the degree that I was most
Wow,
excited.
that sounds wonderful. And you started really early. It's really interesting to know how, people sort of know their path, at a very young age, and they kind of know that, okay, this is what I need to follow. And you pursued infectious diseases. So can you tell us a little bit more about that? Like, what was your learning based on, and what was your initial, and how did you feel about it later?
Yeah, so infectious disease, I think I was initially interested in it because I, come from Nigeria, a West African country, where if you ask people, what are the number one medical problems that people face in that area of the world, it's infectious diseases, malaria, diarrheal diseases, pneumonia. And so was interested in medicine, but specifically interested in infectious disease and understanding how these diseases work and how they're treated. And so that was, I think, just personal background is what sparked the interest. And then also, as a biology nerd, I always loved evolutionary biology as a concept, as a theory. And nothing evolves faster than microbes. And so for a lot of the research that I did in college was understanding microbial evolution, and specifically how that relates to infectious disease. And what we're seeing now with the rise of COVID and these Delta and these new variants that are coming out, I think there's a newfound appreciation for how evolution in infectious disease actually has a huge impact in medicine. And so this has been a really obviously terrible time for people, but academically also very interesting for ideologues and people interested in this field.
Definitely. Well, microbiology wasn't my favorite subject, to be honest. Biochemistry, biology was not like, but I had to do it. So moving on, I would also like to speak about that you've been involved in a lot of initiatives to increase the pipeline of underrepresented minority students in science and medicine, right? So would you like to talk a little bit more about it?
Yeah, so in my experiences doing science and medicine in the US, you know, I went to Yale for undergrad where there weren't that many Black students who were pre-med and who were doing research. And then I went to University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom where if there weren't too many at Yale, in the UK, there was almost zero.
Really?
Very few.
Okay, I'm gonna take a pause. Can you take a little bit, elaborate that? Like, tell us a little bit more about that experience.
Yeah, so I did a master's in biochemistry at the University of Cambridge, and it was under like their general biology degree program, of which there are probably 400 students in like the life sciences, and there were like two Black students out of the 400.
Wow.
So it was very limited. And if you look at, anyone can do this, look up University of Cambridge and like diversity, Black student, Black students in sciences, you'll see that it's a problem that this university has had for a long time. But it's not specific to Cambridge. You know, Yale, my alma mater, had initiatives when I was there and then certainly afterwards to increase the diversity of their sciences. And then same for many medical schools and graduate schools in this country. There's a lot of programs that are geared towards helping to improve the pipeline of students entering, underrepresented minority students entering these programs, because the number of students in these programs do not at all match with the population that, the percentage of their population. And if we want to have a diverse workforce, if you want to have a workforce that can actually mirror what the country will look like in the future, then we need to be doing the work now so that we are better equipped and better represented in the future.
Absolutely. I was just looking at the statistics and I was talking to a couple of friends of mine, and the more I talk to people, I understand that the number of African-American physicians generally, you know, statistically, if you look at it, is quite less as compared to like the general population.
Right. Like 2-3%.
So what initiatives are you actually taking, or what would you see the solution to this problem?
Yeah. So I've done several programs. One of the main ones is this program called HPREP at Harvard. And basically what HPREP does is it's a program geared towards high school students, where for a period of 10 weeks, once a week on Saturday, students come in and they learn a science topic, or they learn a topic in medicine that is interesting and engaging. And then what's really awesome about the program is that they pair each student with a mentor from Harvard Medical School or the grad school in general, where you meet with this student for a couple hours once a week on Saturdays, and you actually work on problems together, work on things like a personal statement, work on a resume, work applying into different programs. It's that sustained mentorship that I think makes the program really impactful. And the students that I have mentored over the years have gone on obviously to go to college, and that they are now applying to medical school and graduate school, and we keep in touch. And so that's one of the programs. Another program I was involved in is, through the Student National Medical Association, that is the SNMA, that is the group in the US that's dedicated towards creating a community for Black and Brown medical students. And in that organization, I was the coordinator for this group called the Physician Researcher Initiative, or PRI. And the goal of that group was to increase the number of Black and Brown students entering academic medicine. And so we put on workshops, we put on seminars, we actually invited different like titans in the field to talk to students. And then we also had like grants program for people to present their research and poster presentations in different conferences. And so these are just like two of the initiatives, but I've also like do informal mentoring with a bunch of students, and in undergrad have also done a lot of work teaching science to students at all ages of, to all types of students, high school, elementary school.
Right, that sounds absolutely amazing. You know, for somebody who wants to reach out or like, let's say, avail these resources, could you potentially provide us a link that we can like, you know, guide them to, or like, you know, the resources?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. So I'd like to like receive those. And I think we'll post that on the website as well, that, you know, anybody who wants to reach out can like avail those resources. But that sounds amazing. Those are the things that we really need, right? Tell us a little bit about COVID, like with the, I'm sorry, did I?
No, I just said the work is really fun.
Right. How is that fun for you? What do you feel when you're doing that?
Yeah, so I would say before I even knew or had the belief that I could be a scientist or a doctor, there were people in my life who believed in me before I could believe in myself. Mm-hmm. This was back in like elementary school and high school. And so mm-hmm. I had mentors who really pushed me and lit the spark in me that said, like, you can do this. And so it's really fun to be that person to somebody else. And you see a student with the potential, or see a student that just has really natural interest in some thing in, you know, something in biology. And you say, hey, do you know that in 5 to 10 years, you could be studying this like all on your own, or you can be the one in a patient's room, like doing this like procedure or like making that diagnosis. And just seeing that inspiration light up is what I think is most fun.
Wow, that sounds brilliant. Yes, you're absolutely right. We do need that mentor or, you know, some sort of, you know, help to move us in the right direction. Tell us a little bit more about the COVID situation and how you think the Delta variant is acting up in US, and what do you think should be the steps?
Yeah, so I think what we're seeing with the Delta variant, but also all the variants that have come up before, is what viruses do best, which is they infect people, they mutate a little bit, and they go on and infect more people and mutate a little bit. And every now and then, one of these mutations are going to lead the virus to have traits that make it more infectious. So the Delta variant is basically a symptom of having unmitigated viral replication. You know, COVID was everywhere in the world, and eventually a mutant came about that was more, that allowed it to infect people more easily, because it just, it's more efficient at getting into our bodies and replicating itself. And so now we have a situation where just being vaccinated, as we're seeing now with the rise of breakthrough infections, is good in that it prevents from serious infection. And like, I always want to stress that point. If you're vaccinated, the chances of you ending up in a hospital sick or intubated or worse, you know, dying is still extremely low. And so that's why people really should get vaccinated, because that's the best protection that modern medicine has towards Delta variant. But at the same time, what we're seeing now is that, you know, people are getting infected who are vaccinated. And then most people who are actually infected in the US are still unvaccinated. And that's like, we need to get people vaccinated. But I think what we're going to see in the future is most likely a return of mask mandates. I think when the CDC relaxed mask mandates for people who are vaccinated, but the US didn't have a way of detailing or seeing or confirming who was vaccinated and who was not, that led to certain communities just being unmasked and unvaccinated and now being exposed to the Delta variant. And so we'll see what the next couple of weeks to months look like. I feel like mask mandates are probably gonna come back for certain indoor settings. And there's gonna be a real push to get as many people vaccinated as possible, because right now it's the Delta variant. There's already a Lambda variant that we know about. And as time goes on and we allow the virus to continually infect people, we're gonna come upon another variant that's gonna, worst comes, like, we don't want this to happen, but we could come up against a variant that is quite resistant to all the vaccines we have out there. And so that's, I think, what we really wanna prevent.
Right, that is a possibility, you know. I don't wanna think about it, I don't know, but so the mRNA vaccine, you know, there's a lot of misconception and there's a lot of misinformation out there. And I know people personally who are like educated, but yet they believe that it causes infertility and they're not getting vaccinated. So can you like tell us a little bit more about that? And also, you know, we have Sinovac also in other parts of the world, and people have been reaching out to me asking like, what's the difference and whether or not the two different, can we mix different vaccines?
Yeah, so I think misinformation in this age is one of the biggest problems we have against public health. There are, and especially with the ease of social media that allows information to spread much more faster than that has typically been, you know, that has kind of happened in the past, makes it such that these myths and these lies and mistruths about the vaccines just spread like wildfire on these social media websites. And that's unfortunate because the way that you get people to trust the vaccines in order to, you know, take them is to actually present factual information in ways that they can understand, and also giving them a time frame in which they can ingest the information and understand it and come up with the solution on with their decision on their own. But we don't have that time because misinformation is just being bombarded at people depending on what sites and like news sources you engage with. So I think solution number one is, I think we really need a concerted public health campaign, not only from the top, but people in local communities, because you're more likely to listen to someone you know and trust than you are to like a, you know, a doctor on TV in Washington, DC. And so until we really have that like concerted all hands on deck public health like squad basically at all levels educating people, I think this misinformation is just going to continue running rampant, unfortunately. I have done a lot of work in Boston and also virtually with communities in different parts of the US, like talking about the vaccines. And the way I talked about the vaccines is I actually talk about the science and I talk about the clinical trials. I think people really, really engage with that information. And it's something that we're not doing enough. But when I talk about vaccines that say, hey, this is what an mRNA is, walk them through the process of how this exact vaccine works. Then I talk about clinical trials, which is also important. How are these trials conducted? Because people want to trust that they're safe. People want to trust that the due diligence was done. And so I actually talk about phase one, I talk about phase two, I talk about phase three. Then I talk about the post-surveillance that happens after vaccines have been sort of introduced to the public and the way that the FDA and the CDC are monitoring side effects and adverse events. Like all of that information may seem dense, but if people have 30 to 45 minutes to hear this, I have found that at the end, people are like, huh, I'm gonna sign up for the vaccine because I know as much as, you know, the scientists know, and I feel more empowered. And so the work that we do in Boston through this group called We Got Us Project is all about empowering people with information. Once you empower them, we're more likely to take it.
All right. I think we need another session on this. We would like to pick your brains on that. But you know, this is something that is very important because a lot of people need to hear this. And I've tried my best to explain like how mRNA, you know, does not stay in, you know, it does not stay in your body. It's like a Snapchat. It disappears after, you know, that's a layman's term of explaining it. Am I correct?
No, that's right. I love
it. Like it's not, it doesn't stay, but like people are like, no, this, you know, so we need more people coming forward, talking about it, you know, getting the right information forward so that, you know, people know what to expect. And then you're right. Like once they know that there's scientific background to it, they will buy into it.
Yeah. One of the things I thought about is that if you watch TV, you'll see people like, you know, Dr. Fauci, Dr. Walensky, these like amazing public health officials doing their job, which is telling people get vaccinated. But when you think about it, that's actually like just not going to be enough. One, they're like, people don't really know them, so it's hard to trust. Yes. But two, what I hope that countries like the United States could have done is like have an hour on primetime television. Yeah. The whole country can tune into if they want. That's like vaccines, right? And like have a really, really smart and intelligible way of understanding what the vaccines are. We didn't really do national campaigns like that. People just assume that, hey, there's a pandemic going around and here's a vaccine. Don't you want to take it? But actually you need to reach people where they are, which is they don't know what the vaccines are and what they do and how they work. Yeah. Teach them. Have a really good national public health campaign. There could have been an hour special. There could have been like commercials, you know, but that I don't think, you know, the old guard, they're like a generation or two higher than we are. And so that sort of thinking is not exactly the first thing that would come to mind. But in social media, there have been amazing videos and amazing slideshows people have put forth. And that just was on the social media aspect, but nothing was like national or even state level in that regard.
Why do you think that is? Are they waiting? I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think I don't want to chalk it all up to generational, but we grew up in a generation with social media at our fingertips, right? And so that is just a natural way that we communicate. Right. But people who are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s who are making the decisions in a room are not going to naturally think, hey, we can use TV in this way, or we can create really interesting, engaging stories and like the ways that people engage with on Instagram and Snapchat. But talking about vaccines, like people are more used to in that generation, you're just like talking about it and saying, hey, this is what you need to do. But I think storytelling is really important when it comes to changing hearts and minds. And there's no story behind the vaccines. There's no real like communication behind them.
Yeah.
So because of that, you know, there's swaths of this country that are like 30% vaccinated and may stay like that for a while, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's so sad, you know, a lot of times people do not realize, and once they have a family member who goes through something really traumatic or ends up in ICU or on a ventilator, that's when they want to get vaccinated. And we're like, it's too late now.
It's too late.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. So winding it up, I think we do definitely need another session with you on COVID vaccine.
Yes.
I will request that. Meanwhile, tell us a little bit more about, you know, you'll be finishing off your program soon. So what are you, what is your next, you know, 5 years? Where do you see yourself? What are your next plans? How do you, where is your journey taking you?
Yeah, I love this. It's like a classic interview question for for like a job.
I'm interviewing you for your next job.
So I'm actually applying to residency.
The next question is, what is your weakness? It's coming
my
up.
Weakness is my greatest strength. That's my response. Yeah. No, I am
hard.
I'm applying to residency programs right now. Applying to internal medicine. And the goal, I'm keeping an open mind, but the goal would most likely be to do infectious disease after that.
Right.
And so I also love science and want to continue doing research. And in 5 years from now, which is hopefully when I'll be done with the training, I'll be a physician scientist, doctor who is specialized in infectious disease. At the same time, other stuff that I want to do and I'm interested in is these like public health campaigns sort of work. And so I'm very interested in how physicians and scientists communicate science and medicine to the public, because as we see with COVID, it's very important that people have some literacy, some understanding. So I want to do that work. And then also continuing with the mentorship, continuing with the work to increase the diversity in these fields, whether that be through like programs, mentoring students myself, or getting involved in more like institutional policy or even government policy regarding that. Because I think it's so vitally important that we get this right moving forward.
It gets out of hand.
Yeah.
Right. Again, what is your biggest weakness? That's the last question. We'll have to round it up because the time is running short and I know you have to rush off also. But tell us some story about your childhood that you feel has really affected how you think and feel, or any other, you know, anything that you feel the audience can benefit from your experience or your challenges.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a fantastic question that I'm like trying to think, what is a good childhood experience that has influenced me? I think the thing that comes to mind is a time in seventh grade where I got my report card back. And so to give context, I went to public schools in the Bronx and went and then also did a like program for gifted students that allowed me to go to a private school in New York City. That private school is Horace Mann. So Bronx public schools, I did well in, because a lot of the material that they were teaching was a little bit lower than what I had already like studied on my own. And so it was easy for me to get A's. When I went to my private school in the Bronx, the level of education and the material we were taught was just so much higher. And even though I was prepared from that gifted program, it still just wasn't enough. Right. And so when I got my first report card back, I got all B's and like a C in English or something, right? And so This was obviously devastating to me, but what I didn't realize was just how much more devastating it was to my parents, specifically my dad. Because when thinking about it, like, this education was always the key to accessing a better life for him and also his kids. Yeah. And so when he saw that I was going to a private school, and instead of doing as well as I can, I was getting B's and C's, he was just like very, very disappointed. I was also disappointed in myself too, but I think, you know, after that experience, I still like didn't do that well in seventh grade and even in eighth grade. I definitely like improved as I got more comfortable in this new learning environment. But I think that I bring up that story to say that was my first time in my life realizing that how important education is and how much working hard was not only for myself, but also because a lot of my parents' dreams and my extended family's dreams in Nigeria were resting on me and my siblings, you know, taking full advantage of the opportunities that we were being afforded. Right. And he felt, and at that time, that, you know, I was at this illustrious school, but wasn't taking full advantage of everything that the school could offer. Thankfully, I worked hard, I improved. I'm not someone who, like, I have to study, I have to work hard, we all do, in order to do well. And I say that when you find the conclusion or the point of that story is that when you find yourself with opportunities that are amazing, like, you really want to take full advantage, because you never know how that can launch you to the very next thing. And I take that lesson with me to heart.
That is brilliant. That sounds so good. And thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for asking all these lovely questions.
No, it was fantastic talking to you, and you're such an inspiring person. And thank you again for taking time out for this. I know you're very busy and you have to rush off, but I'm really thankful to you for doing this. And we will talk about COVID at some point.
Yes. COVID is one of my favorite topics.
Okay. Thank you. Bye. Take care. Bye.